Mix crew, this is your girl Leah B, and I welcome you guys to In the Mix with Leah B, where I provide a history lesson on all things related to Black music and Black culture. And I hope you guys are having an awesome Memorial Day. Hope you guys are eating good and all that good stuff, enjoying the summer weather, well, wherever you are, the summer weather unofficially, because it's like 84 degrees over here where I'm at in the great city of Detroit. And hope you guys are eating good and all that stuff like that. And I normally drop my episodes, you know, on Saturdays and everything like that, but I decided to do give y'all a back-to-back type of thing. So as you know, I dropped the Shanice episode on Saturday. So if you haven't checked that out, go ahead and check that out. It is out now. And in this episode, is like a special episode. So thought I figured I would do it. So technically it's episode 72. So, let's get into it. So this episode, as you know, a few days ago, the music world lost a legend, and that legend was Tina Turner. She was known as the Queen of Rock and Roll. So let's get into this episode. So Tina was born Anna Mae Bullock in November 26, 1939 in Brownsville, Tennessee. She was the youngest of three. Her dad was a overseer of sharecroppers, and her mom was a stay-at-home wife and whatnot. And she grew up in Nutbush, Tennessee. As you know, she had a song about Nutbush, Tennessee. So she was old to her hometown and whatnot. So as a kid, she would pick cotton with her dad, her dad and her sisters and whatnot. And she had two older sisters named Evelyn and Ruby. And one of her sisters was a songwriter. And as kids, the three sisters were separated when her parents located to Knoxville, Tennessee. And that's because her dad worked at a defense facility during the Second World War. So she went to stay with her strict grandparents and whatnot. And her grandparents were deacons at the church that she grew up at. And so she stayed with them for a while. And after World War II, her and her sisters were reunited and with her parents and whatnot. And they moved back to Knoxville. And then after that, they relocated to Nutbush, Tennessee and whatnot. So as a young girl, she began her singing at Nutbush's Spring Hill Baptist Church. And that's when she was 11, her mom had a terrible relationship with her dad. And I guess her mom ran off and because her dad was abusing her, and her mom moved to ran to St. Louis in 1950, and that's when after her mom left her family, her dad remarried another woman and moved to Detroit. And so by then, her child basically her childhood was not a very good one, pretty much, because her back and forth, her mom left, her dad was abusive, and her parents were just going through it. So her and her sisters moved with her another grandmother on her mom's side, and she just felt like she wasn't wanted. So during that time, as a teenager living with her grandma, she worked as a domestic worker for a family named the Henderson family. And come to find out, while she was working at the house, Henderson's house, one of her sisters had passed away, had died in a plane crash along with her cousins and whatnot. And so in high school, she played a lot of sports. She was what you call a tomboy. Even though she joined the cheerleading squad and also joined the basketball team as well. And after high school, she worked as a nurse in a hospital and whatnot. So by the end of high school, she started when she was in St. Louis with her mom and whatnot. Her sister, one of her sisters, Ruby, who was the songwriter, they would frequent a lot of nightclubs in St. Louis and East St. Louis and whatnot. And that's when she saw Ike Turner for the very first time. And during that time, he was in a band called Kings of Rhythm. And he was at this popular nightclub in East St. Louis called the Manhattan Nightclub. And that when she saw him, she was like taken back by his talent and whatnot. And she was so impressed by his talent, she almost like went into a trance. Like, oh my God, like this dude, like, oh my God, he's just so amazing. Oh my God. And once, I guess, one night while he was performing, she actually asked him if she could sing with his group, even though he never let a woman sing with him. So she gave him a shot, gave her a shot and whatnot. And at first he was like, "No, nah, I ain't gonna do it, you know, whatever. I'm not the type to, you know, have a woman sing in my group or whatever." So one night in 1958, 1957, when he was performing with his band, she took the mic and was like, she sang during an intermission. She sang a B.B. King song called "I Know That You I You Know That I Love You." And upon her singing, Ike was so impressed, he asked her if she knew any more songs. So she sang the whole rest of the night. And became a featured vocalist in her band. So during that time, He taught her, basically gave her skills on how to, gave her a few pointers on how to control her voice, vocal control, stage presence, things of that nature. And while he was teaching her points and everything, she recorded her first recording was a year later in 1958, and under her name, the name Little Ann, and she had a single called Box Top. And she was credited as a vocalist on the record along with Ike and the other bands. Another group member of Kings of Rhythm called, his name was Carlson Oliver. And by 1960, she wrote her first song called A Fool in Love for a singer named Art Lelzinger. And she sang background vocals for this guy. And one day, the guy didn't even show up. So, for the actual recording session, so already she paid for the session and everything like that. So, since he suggested Tina that he to sing on behalf of him because he didn't show up, the art guy didn't show up. So basically, when she did that, he had the nerve to like. So he once he she recorded the demo with the intention of erasing her vocals for the guy at a later date, but I guess a local DJ discovered in St. Louis, saw the tape or whatever, and convinced Ike to just keep the vocals, her vocals on the tape, and to send it to a guy named Jiggy Maury. He was the president of this R&B label called Sue Records. So upon hearing the song, Murray, the president of Sue Records, he was so impressed with her vocals that he quoted as saying that Tina sounded like screaming dirt. So it's like a funky sound. So the guy bought Murray bought the track and paid Ike $25,000 advance for recording and publishing rights. He also convinced that to make he convinced Ike to make Tina the star of the show. So basically, that's how her got her name, her stage name. And Ike said he re and requested calling her Tina because it rhymed with Sheena. Why, I don't know. Even though her family and friends still called her Ann, but he was inspired by some chick named Sheena. And I guess he was impressed, so he said, "I'm gonna name you Tina." That's what he did. So he added his last name to her stage name, Tina, and trademarked his name as a form of protection. And she said that he had the nerve to basically say if she left the group, left him like previous singers did, he's gonna replace her with another Tina Turner. So I was like, wow, okay. So her early success, she was introduced to the public as Tina Turner with a song with the song that the guy never showed up on, that Ike Turner wrote for her, called A Fool in Love in 1960. So the song reached number 2 on the Hot Billboard Sides chart and number 27 on the Hot Billboard Hot 100. Kurt Loder, who was on MTV, he described the track as the blackest record ever. And it creeped up into the white charts since. So he said it's the blackest record ever to creep onto the black pop, white pop chart since Ray Charles' song, What Did I Say, the previous summer. So another single that was released called It's Gonna Work Out Fine reached number 14 on the Hot 100 and number 2 on the Billboard R&B chart in 1961, which earned them their first Grammy nomination for Best Rock and Roll Performance. And other singles that Ike and Turner came out with between 1960 and 1962 was called I Idolize You and Poor Fool and Try La La La. And after the release of Fool in Love, Ike created the Ike and Turner Review, which included his group Kings of Rhythm and a girl group, the Ike Nets, who were the backup vocalists and dancers as well. He remained in the background as, you know, the band leader pretty much, and he basically put the group through a tough, winuous touring schedule. So they traveled all across the United States, performing 90 days straight at all different venues and across the countries and whatnot. And during that time, they were on the Chitlin Circuit. While they were on the Chitlin Circuit, they built the Ike and Turner Review built a reputation as like one of the hottest, durable, potentially most explosive R&B ensembles, like arriving James Brown and his group. So basically, they put on a huge show. So they were like pretty much electrifying. Like they just had it. They were that deal. And during their profitable performances, they were able to perform in front of desegregated. So, you know, as you know, during that time, it was during the 1960s. So everything was, you know, segregated. So they were able to perform in front of desegregated audience in the South and in hotels. So by 1963 and 1965, the band toured constantly and produced successful moderately successful R&B singles. So Tina Turner's first credited single as a solo artist was called Too Many Ties That Bind and We Need an Understanding, was released on his Ike's independent label called Sonya Records in 1964. And another single by the duo was called Cannot Miss a Thing That You Never Had, reaching number 29 on the Billboard R&B chart. And after their tenure on Sue Records, they signed another record deal with 10 more with more labels at the remainder of the decade. So they signed with 10 other record labels called Kent, Tangerine, Pomone, A&M, Minty. And in 1964, they signed with Luma Records, which is a conglomerate of Warner Brothers. And it was run by a guy named Bob Kinsnow. And he became their manager shortly after they left Sue Records. And while on Warner Brothers, they achieved their first charting album called Live with the Ike and Tina Show, peaking at number 8. And peaking at number 8 on the Billboard's LP charts. And they had a song called, the single was called Tell Her I'm Not Home, which was released on Luma. And Goodbye So Long, that was released on Martin Records. So they signed a lot of record companies, signed with a lot of record companies. And, let's see. Also, those songs were top 10 R&B charts, R&B hits in 1965. So her profile was raised after a few solo performances and all that good stuff. And people began to take notice into them. And they also due to her first solo performance, she was on several shows at that time, American Bandstand, Shindig. While the entire review appeared on Hollywood Go-Go in 1965. In 1965, Phil Spector attended a show of theirs at the Sunset Strip in LA. And during that time, he invited them to appear in a concert show film called the Big TNT Show. So by this time, they were humongous. And that's when they achieved solo success at that time. And So impressed by the duo's performance in the movie The Big Ten Show, Phil Spector was so eager to produce Ike. So they worked out a deal called with Ike and Tina's manager, who was the head of their record label. Phil Spector offered a $20,000 for creative control over the sessions to produce Ike and them, and have them be released with their current record label, Luma. So they signed with Spector's label called Philly's label in 1966 after Ike recorded with them. And their first single on his label was called River Deep Mountain High, which was released in 1966, May of 1966. Phil considered that record with Tina's energy over the Wall of Sound. So that was a big thing, the Wall of Sound was during that time. And it was that song, River Deep Mountain High, was huge over overseas. And reaching at number 3 on the UK charts and number 1 on the Spanish charts in Spain, but it didn't go any higher. It only stopped at number 88 on the Billboard Hot 100. So with the success of that record, it gave Ike and Tina an opening spot on the Rolling Stones tour. They were, as you know, the Rolling Stones were huge back in them days, in that fall of 66. So by November of 67, Tina became the first female artist and the first black artist to appear on Rolling Stones magazine. And that they signed with another record label called Blue Thumb Records in 1968, releasing the album Out of Season in 1969. The album, they did a cover of Otis Redding song called I've Been Loving You Too Long, and they released another album called The Hunter, and it earned Tina another Grammy nomination for Best Female Vocal Performance. So the success of those two albums led the review to have a headlining venue in Vegas, where it was attended by huge celebrities at that time, like David Bowie, Sly Stone, Janis Joplin, Cher, James Brown, Ray Charles, Elton John, and Elvis Presley. So, by the fall in 1969, the Ike and Tina profile was raised again after opening for going on while they're on tour with the Rolling Stones. They had a U.S. tour during that time, and they gained more exposure. They were hot. They were like extremely hot. They were on the Ed Sullivan Show, Playboy After Dark, the Andy Williams Show. So they released two more albums in 1970 called Come Together and Working Together. And their cover, I Want to Take You Higher, peaked at number 34, which it was released by Sly and the Family Stone. And it peaked below. So when Sly and the Family Stone originally made that song, it peaked four numbers below when Tina and Ike remade it. It was huge. So the Come Together and Working Together albums marked the turning point in their career. So that's when they switched from R&B to incorporate a more rock sound. And they had the songs Come Together, Honky Tonk Woman, and Get Back. So the early, by 1971, they redid Creedence Clearwater Revival's Proud Mary, and that became the biggest hit of their career. Proud Mary became huge. That reached number 4 on the Hot 100 and sold more than 1 million copies, and that's when they won their first Grammy for Best R&B Performance by a Duo or Group. And then they released their live album, What You Hear Is What You Get, and it was recorded at Carnegie Hall and became their first gold album. And later that year, they had a top 40 R&B hit called Ooh Poo Ta Do, and the first three singles, I Am Yours, Use Me Any Way You Wanna, and Up In Here, and Early Morning, which was a Little Richard cover, peaked at number 47 on the R&B chart. So by 1972, they had basically moved to LA, and they had a recording studio in Inglewood, and they signed to another record label called United Artists Records. And around this time, by 1972, she began writing writing more songs for this. She was in her writing songwriter's bag by that time. And she wrote 9 out of the 10 songs on their 1972 album called Feel So Good, which they had the single Nut Bush City Limits, which was owed to her city, Nutbush, Tennessee. It peaked at number 22 on the pop charts and number 11 on the R&B charts, which was penned by Tina. And it reached number 1 in Austria, number 4 in the UK, and number 5, and top 5 in several other countries. And it was certified silver by the BPI, which is, I think it's the British, I forgot, it was the British something, which sold 250,000 in the UK. So as a result of their success, they received several European awards called the Golden European Award, which was the first ever given to them, which sold for the song Nuts Bush City Limits, which basically sold 1 million copies at that time. And then they had made a gospel record called, it was actually nominated, called The Gospel According to Ike and Tina, which was nominated for Best Soul Gospel Performance. And Ike also received a nomination for the single Father Alone, which was his, like, I don't think they won anything for that. And Tina had made her first solo album called Tina Runs the Country, and earned her another nomination for Best R&B Vocal Performance Female. So later that year, she actually went into acting for the very first time. And she was in a rock opera called Tommy in London. So she played an acid queen who was addicted, who was a drug addicted prostitute. And it was actually critically acclaimed. And after that, she appeared on another TV special. And following the release of Tommy in 1975, she made another solo album called Acid Queen, which reached number 39 on the Billboard R&B charts. And it produced charting singles called Baby Get It On, which is a Led Zeppelin song. It was the Led Zeppelin song was called A Whole Lot of Love. So Baby Get It On and Led Zeppelin's cover that she did was A Whole Lot of Love. So a year later, by 1976, Ike became addicted to cocaine, which hindered their working relationship. And so he made plans to leave United Artists Records with a 4 or 5 year deal with Cream Records for $150,000 per year. But the deal was to be signed like 5 days later in July 5th, 1976. So on July 1st, the Turners flew from LA to Dallas, where the Review had a gig at Stellar Hilton in downtown Dallas. So basically, while en route, Ike and Tina got into an altercation while they were going to the hotel. And once she arrived, that's when they actually got married. They actually was married at that time. And so he was basically abusive, extremely abusive towards her. And once he did that, they were done. Like, he was totally abusive. Like, she was sick and tired of his abuse. So she fled and only had 36 cents and a mobile gas card. And she went to Ramada Inn. And that's when she filed for divorce from him on July 27th. And it was finalized in 1978. So after their separation, United Artists released two more albums from them called Delilah's Power and Airwaves. And that's when she actually started her solo career after they split. And in 1976 and 77, she earned income due to her split and having 36 cent in her pocket. She earned income by appearing on TV shows like Hollywood Squares, Donny and Marie, Sonny and Cher Show, and the Brady Bunch Hour. So after divorcing from Ike, there were lawsuits. People were coming after them. There were all lawsuits due to them canceling gigs and stuff like that. And she remained resumed touring to pay off the debts with the finances. It was basically from the record label that she was with, that they were with United Artists. So she had to pay off her debts by touring. And by 1977, after her divorce, she reemerged with a whole new image. It was like a very sexy image as well. And she had her costumes were created by Bob Mackie. And she headlined with her new look. She headlined a series of cabaret shows at Palace, Caesar's Palace in Vegas. And she took her solo act to smaller venues here in the US. And later that year in 1977, she went on her first solo concert tour in Australia. In 1978, she released her third solo album called Rough on United Artists. She had a distribution deal with EMI, and she had a follow-up album in 79 called Love Explosion, which by that time disco became popular at that time as well. And so it had she had a she touched a little brief disco with that album, but it didn't do well. It failed the chart, and by that time, United Artists Records and her parted ways. So, without a hit record, she continued to tour, and she went on her second tour of Australia. So, an Australian manager. Name her Australian manager named Roger Davies agreed to manage her after seeing her perform at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco. And She worked in Italy as a regular performer on a TV series. Later that year, she did a 5-week tour of South Africa during the apartheid regime as well. And even though she was like totally like during that time, she regretted actually performing in South Africa at that time. She's quoted with saying she was naive about the politics in South Africa. So by 1981, Rod Stewart attended her show in New York and was invited her to perform Hot Legs on Saturday Night Live. In November of that year, she opened up for the Rolling Stones again. Previously, when she was with Ike, she opened up solo during their 1981 tour. And in 82, she performed. She was continue to perform on like TV shows and stuff, and performed on this show in the Netherlands. And she had a hit called "Shame, Shame, Shame," which reached number 47 in the Netherlands in 1982. She did a cover of The Temptations, song called "Ball of Confusion" for for the UK production team of that show. So, "Ball of Confusion" became a European hit in the dance clubs. And also, she appeared on a the I'm sorry, the production team was called BEF. And while working with them, they became they produced the song "Ball of Confusion," which was like a dance type of vibe, and it hit number. Became a hit on the European dance clubs. So by 1980, also in 1982, she appeared on their album called "Music of Quality and Destruction," Distraction, Distinction. I'm sorry, Distinction, Volume 1 by BEF, which was like a side project of the song of an album they had called Heaven 17, and they sang "Ball of Confusion," and she actually did a music video for that song as well, and it aired on MTV. This is when MTV was just starting out, and that's when the music video was beginning to take hold by that time. And she became one of the first black artists to gain airtime on MTV by that time. And she appeared on Chuck Berry's television special at the Roxy in West Hotel. So by 1983, she had a career resurgence. So until by like 1983, people considered her as a nostalgia act. So basically, she was just singing songs at like hotel ballrooms, clubs in the United States and whatnot. So people wasn't really feeling her like that. So during her second stint at the Ritz-Carlton, that's when she signed with Capitol Records. And Capitol Records released her cover. She had a cover by Al Green, his Al Green song, "Let's Stay Together," which was produced by that production team, BEF, which reached several European charts at that time. So it peaked at number 6 in the UK. And in the US, it peaked at number 26 on the Billboard Hot 100 and went to number 1 on the dance club charts and number three on the black, on the hot black singles charts as well. So during that single, I mean, during her doing the cover of Al Green's song "Let's Stay Together," that's when they were Capitol Records approved a studio album for her, and she only had 2 weeks to record that album, and the album was called "Private Dancer," which was released in 1984, and that peaked at number three on the Billboard Hot 100, Billboard 200, and number two in the United Kingdom. So that album went five times platinum in the U.S. and sold 10 million copies at that time, and became her most successful album. So after her her divorce and all that stuff, and being known as just a nostalgia act and all that stuff, that's when this album put her back on the map. And also on that album, which became the second single and became her biggest hit ever, "What's Love Got to Do with It," was actually being recorded by a pop group named Bucks Fizz. So after the album's release, she toured with Lionel Richie on his tour. In September of 84, she received her one and only number one hit, and that was with "What's Love Got to Do with It." And she had follow-up singles called "Better Be Good to Me" and "Private Dancer." "You're my private dancer," something like that. "Dancer for money." Yeah. Which both were U.S. pop. It went top 10 on the U.S. charts. So it was released as a single in November and peaked at number 53 on the U.S. and the U.K. Charts as well. And that same year, she did a duet with David Bowie for a cover called "Tonight," which was performed by Iggy Pop. And it peaked at that's the single that peaked at number 53 on the U.S. and U.K. charts. So with her comeback by the 80s, she basically was everywhere by 19. That whole decade was her, period. No doubt. And she cemented her comeback when she won 3 Grammys. For Best Record of the Year with "What's Love Got to Do with It." And that's when she embarked on her second world tours to support the Private Dancer album. And she was everywhere. She was in a movie with Mel Gibson for a song, for a, it was a post film. I don't think it did very well, because I don't remember it. Well, I was like one, but I don't remember ever seeing it. It was called Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome. And she played, it was her first acting role in 10 years. So she portrayed a glamorous Auntie Inti, the ruler of Barbertown. Okay, that sounds really whack. I'm sorry, but it does. Like, what? It sounds like really, really bad. So, it actually did. People enjoyed her performance. And it went, no, it was a huge success. It grossed over $36 million at the box office. And she recorded 2 songs for the the album as well. And it was called the album. The song itself was "We Don't Need Another Hero" and "One for the Living," which became hits as well. She received her another Grammy Award for Best Female Rock Performance. By 1985, she performed at Live Aid with Mick Jagger. And she did a duet with Bryan Adams called "It's Only Love," which was nominated for the Grammy Award. And she also won an MTV Video Music Award as well for Best Stage Performance. So the 80s, she was everywhere. Everybody loved her. That's why she was known as the Queen of Rock and Roll. Homegirl was doing it. And she also received an NAACP Image Award for that film she was in with Mel Gibson. So she was on tour in London with Eric Clapton. And that's when she released her sixth album in 1986 called "Break Every Rule," which reached number one in four countries and sold over 5 million. 5 million copies in the U.S. So, and then on that album, she had the number one hit, international hit, called "The Best" in 1990. And so by the 90s, she did her first, it was her first foreign affair European tour, which drew 4 million spectators, breaking the record for the European tour that previously was held by the Rolling Stones. So 1991, she released her greatest hits album compilation called "Simply the Best," which sold 7 million copies, and that was her biggest seller in the UK. She was huge in Europe, which was certified 8 times platinum and sold, which was 2 million copies sold in 91. Also in 1991, her and Ike were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. At that time, Ike was in prison. Yeah. And Tina did not attend to the ceremony. So, yeah. So, by that time, I think she was living in Europe at that time. And in 93, that's when "What's Love Got to Do With the Movie" came out. And it starred Angela Bassett as Tina Turner and Lawrence Fishburne as Ike. Oh my God, that movie was, I didn't see it as a kid, but I remember seeing it years ago. Like, oh my God, years later. And I tell you, Angela Bassett killed that role. Her and Lawrence Fishburne. I'm like, dude, they should have won it. They should have won Oscars for that. They were nominated for Best Actress and Best Actor. It was crazy. Like, they killed that role. My God, that was like, whew. Like, if anyone who could embody Tina, she could do it. I'm sorry, but the girl killed it. Her and Lawrence. So, she wasn't really involved in the film like that. Tina wasn't. But she contributed to the soundtrack. Basically re-recording all the old songs that she had. And she had a song called, "I Don't Wanna Fight," from the soundtrack, which went to number top 10 hit. It was a top 10 hit in the US and the UK. And by 93, she went on her maybe seventh tour called What's Love Tour, which basically was a North American tour and did a few shows in the Australia and Europe. And 95, she went back into the studio and she released Golden Eye, which was written by Bono and The Edge of U2 for the movie Golden Eye. I actually remember that song as a kid. And then 1996 came. She released the Wildest Dreams album. And she had a Wildest Dreams tour a year later. I actually remember that too, because she was on Oprah talking about it. And Oprah had her on her show. And she was a huge fan of hers. Period. I just remember that episode when she was on there. And then, so in 1999, September of 99, before celebrating her 60th birthday, she released a dance song called When the Heartache Is Over, which was from her 10th and final solo album, 24/7. And the success of that single and the following tour was certified gold by the RIAA. And the 24/7 tour was the highest grossing tour of 2000 and ranked over $120 million. Her concerts were at Wembley Stadium, and they were recorded for a DVD and everything like that. By July of 2000, on her last tour in Switzerland, that's when she announced that she will retire at the end of that tour. So by 2001, she was honored by the White House at the Kennedy Center Honor in December of 2005 and whatnot. And everybody was there. Yeah, so she was honored by Bush, congratulating her, doing a reception at the Kennedy Honor Center. In November of 2004, she released All the Best, which peaked at number 2 at the Billboard 200 charts. And it did really well. And then in 2006, she released another album with a Italian singer called Teach Me Again. It was for a film called The Invisible Children. And that was donated to the singles, donated to charity and whatnot. And then she made a comeback at the Grammy Awards, where she performed with Beyonce. I remember that she performed with her and whatnot. In addition, that's why they call Beyonce Tina Turner, because that's like her, she's like the hugest Tina Turner fan. But anyway, in addition, at the 08 Grammy Award, she was a featured artist on Joni Mitchell's album Joni Letters, and she embarked on her first tour in 10 years called Tina, the 50th anniversary tour. And she released a compilation album and whatnot. So, yeah. So basically, in 2018, she received the Lifetime Achievement Award and wrote a memoir in 2018. She came out of retirement in 2020 and did a remix of What's Love Got to Do with It. And with that release, she became the first artist to have top 40 hits in seven consecutive decades in the UK. And she released her third book in 2020 called Happiness Becomes You, A Guide of Changing Your Life for the Good. And she co-wrote it with an author by name Tero Gold and Swiss singer Rula Carly. So by 2021, she sold her rights to BMG and for an estimated $50 million. And with Warner Brothers handling distribution of music. So, and also in 2021, she was inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a solo artist, accepting her award near her home in Switzerland. So yes, y'all, this is like the longest episode I ever did. It is an hour. So I thank you guys for listening to this episode and enjoying this special episode. So I decided to do an episode on her. May she, Tina, Miss Tina, rest in peace to the queen of rock and roll. So, all right, y'all. It's been real. If you want to follow my podcast, In the Mix with Leah B, I'm on all streaming social medias, In the Mix with Leah B. In the Mix with Leah B on social, on IG, Facebook, Twitter. I also have a website, inthemixwithleahb.com. And also, I'll be dropping these merch very soon. So give me some time. So it'll be coming soon. So, all right, y'all. Peace and love.